Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm that control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. It's been going strong for over 44 years now. Every Sunday night at around 8 p.m., we meet in front of our radios and discuss things, learn from each other, teach each other, and hopefully entertain each other. And I thank you once again for joining me this Sunday night at 8 p.m., but we try and do this all over again. Let me drop for a second, and I will return with the usual link. Okay, if you want to reach me via email, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you want to ask Paul to take a look at a NASA space-related story, you can contact him directly. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. Also, as always, I cut and paste interesting articles and YouTube videos and what have you into a link page and publish it every weekend so that you can, if you have a little bit of insomnia and you'd like to read some articles that at least I found interesting, you just type into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the link page, and it'll be available for almost forever. Also, we have a chat room available. Sometimes it's quiet, sometimes it's noisy. You get there by typing into your browser, chat.ac2gs.com. We offer an audio stream of the Technical Net on the Internet for people who don't have access to a radio or they're not within radio distance. I originally set it up for the Technical Net, but some people asked me to keep it live the rest of the week, so it's live pretty much the rest of the week. You get there by typing into your browser, technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you the audio stream. And as always, I like to remind people that MyKC2NJI has a great archive site called amateurradio.tv. It's seen more than a million visitors, and it has archives of the Limark Technical Net that go as far back as September of 2006. So avail yourself of the wisdom of people who moved out of the area or become silent keys, unfortunately. Their wisdom remains in the audio files, and you can peruse them to your heart's content. So that's the usual links. I'll drop, come back, and tell you what we got planned for tonight. Okay, we got a vanilla version of the Technical Net. We have no guest speakers of any kind. I will say a couple of things about artificial intelligence at the top of the net as I am given to. There's really not that much news these days. Everything's just kind of simmering, and everyone's kind of, I guess, waiting for the bubble to burst. We'll see. So we'll start with that. I will then go for questions, comments, and topics from the audience. If you have any, I would prefer amateur radio-related questions first, but we can always we'll always attempt to answer or help with any science and or technology subject you can throw at us. That should take us approximately to 10:15, and Paul WS2N will join us for the SpaceNet report. That should take us to approximately 11 p.m., and I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the coming week. So that's the plan. If everything works correctly, my shack continues to work fine, the repeater works fine, and I don't get kicked off of All-Star too many times. Usually one or two every Sunday seems to be the average number, but I've had worse nights. So we'll see how things go. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you my little short story about AI for this week. Okay, like I said, a couple more articles about bubbles bursting, and of course the stock market is having some jitters for a whole bunch of different reasons. So I'm glad this isn't an economic net. Apparently, good old Sam Altman made an announcement this past week. And there's an old theory about technology that the first technology starts to work reasonably well, efficiently, is with pornography. We saw this with videotape recorders. It was kind of a half-assed type of thing until everyone discovered that they could rent and buy pornography on videotape recorders, and so VCRs took off rather well. It even has a history in computers. There were bulletin board services that almost all of them had vaguely pornographic ASCII art available, and some percentage of, you know, teenagers with computers kind of toiled to maintain and upload and download from bulletin board services. And, of course, a lot of the Internet is filled with pornography. So I guess in that view, Sam Altman announced that he's going to kind of take the censors away from ChatGPT and allow more sexual content in it, much like I think Grok had announced the spicy setting. So this is usually not a good sign for a technology when people start to run to pornography or softcore pornography. It's kind of is a mark of some degree of desperation, but we'll see how things go. We're always watching AI, and we'll keep an eye on it for the coming weeks and see what's happening. Right now, one of the big things that I've talked about here, and some people agree and some people disagree, is I tend to disagree that generative AI is as scalable as guys like Sam Altman and Elon Musk seem to be enthusiastic about. And I think what we're seeing, among other things, is a somewhat failure to scale. I haven't really read of any kind of amazing breakthroughs in later generation AIs. Again, they're just talking about including pornography and other things. So it'll be interesting to see what AI does in the coming weeks and how it's going to interact with the stock market. And because a lot of the companies that are holding the stock market up are kind of tech, and they're all kind of depending upon great things from AI. So we'll see. Anyway, before we get to the main segment of the Technical Net, if anyone has any comments about this, please feel free to hit that push to talk. Okay, Jim, you doubled with someone. We'll take you first, and the person that you doubled with will take him second. So what can I do you for, Jim?
Just my usual. It's fake intelligence, a fancy version of a tilted survey. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. That's my feeling on the whole thing. Obviously, it would have more impact than that, but that's at its base, what I think. Back to you.
Okay, well, we've discussed this more than a few times. One of my great fears is that in addition, you know, I wouldn't mind if that was just it, but it, people have kind of blown $1 trillion into this balloon. So the ramifications of $1 trillion evaporating overnight is very scary. I mean, a cryptocurrency had a little bump in the night where I think something like $18 billion disappeared or something close to that. So, you know, $1 trillion is a heck of a lot more. So it may come to nothing, it may come to something, but it's certainly going to have ramifications in the economy, whatever happens to it. The person who doubled with Jim, please ID yourself.
Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf, and the question is, what do you mean by scalable?
What I mean by scalable is some things that you could scale up, you know, they have some limitation eventually. One of the problems with human beings is they love to look at curves, and they love to extrapolate them in a way that the slope always remains the same. So if the stock market is going up, they just draw a straight line and they say, well, anyone who doesn't invest in this is an idiot because it's going to be worth, you know, if you talk to people about Elon Musk with a straight face, they'll tell you some ridiculous thing like this. The stock should have been. A couple of years ago, I saw a copy of a video where a investment analyzer said that the stock for Tesla should be about $4,000 a share today, where it's actually something like $300 and change. So with intelligence, if you can scale it up, that's the big thing where they're talking about godlike intelligence. So if you can have something that sort of simulates something that can answer a college-level question, not because it understands the question or understands what it's saying, but it's, again, more a paragraph generating from your question algorithm through the probability and such. But the concept is that they hope to be able to scale it up to be smarter and smarter and smarter. The more GPU units, the more silicon, the more circuit boards, the bigger the server farm, the smarter the computer. So they're hoping that they can get the processing time down, because some of these processing times take a lot more than we realize. But also they just want the limitations at the point where the intelligence just kind of runs out of steam to go farther and farther, higher and higher, until it's a superhuman genius. So that's what I mean by scalability, which I don't think is a real thing for anything. You can't scale anything infinitely. Ultimately, something goes wrong.
Well, what's the scalability of gold these days?
Well, gold doesn't scale. Demand for gold goes up, and the relative value of currency goes down. So it's possible, you know, you've read newspaper reports of countries that have severe inflation. You know, there are countries, unfortunately, where you would have to bring a bushel basket of currency to buy a loaf of bread. So, you know, there is no limit in the possible currency exchange for a given weight of gold. I wouldn't call that scalability. It's just a combination of scarcity. If someone kind of destroyed our gold reserves, the price would go up. Or if someone destroyed the dollar, then the price would go up. So that's kind of what's going on right now.
It's also very hard to conceive that intelligence can exceed our intelligence. We're the ones who are creating the intelligence.
Yeah, I mean, there are some philosophers that kind of talk about that, but what's a little bit annoying, an extra little wiggle in this, is IT guys ultimately don't know what's in the programs that they're running, because you set up the initial algorithms, but the parameter settings are set by itself through learning processes. You show the AI a bunch of things, and you see if they detect it correctly. If they detect it correctly, you don't change the parameters. If they get it wrong, you adjust the parameters and test again and again and again. So at the end of the day, there's no one around who actually understands what these AIs are fundamentally doing. They're teaching themselves, unfortunately. Sometimes that might be a good thing, but it might be a terrible thing.
Well, Roy, as an attorney, what's really weird is I'm getting people transmitting or conveying to me by email documents, and the AI comes on and says, the document is very long. Do you want us to tell you what it says? And that really blows me away, because that's happening on a lot of documents that I am receiving as an attorney. Back to you.
Well, this is the companies that are losing a lot of money, that are investing a lot of money, trying to turn this into a solution to a dubious problem. So this is what a business has been doing for decades now. They and actually drug dealers have been using that even probably longer. They give you a sample, they give you a free supply, or they give it to you discounted until they hook you. And then they charge you more money. You know, it's what you saw for streaming of video. At first, it was a very nominal fee, but once they got enough people in the tent, they tightened things up, and every 4 to 6 months, the price of all these streaming services are going no place but up. So that's unfortunately, they're stuffing AI into everything. I make the perpetual joke that eventually they'll be selling Cheerios with AI. So I'm not surprised. Everything is being labeled AI, especially any kind of business and or office related job is being, they're getting cheap AI for the time being, you know, until they kind of sucker us all in, and then they'll squeeze us.
Well, what I think is that people are afraid of missing the boat. When Bluetooth came out as a stock, people didn't even know what it was, and they were buying into the stock, and it, of course, skyrocketed. But today, we understand what Bluetooth is, and, you know, it's integrated into our lives now. But like Amazon, when it started to sell books, you know, people didn't fathom the reality of where that was going. So I think that with AI, it could be a similar type of concept where people are afraid of missing the boat of the next big thing. Back to you.
Yeah, I agree with you, but I mean the dot-com bubble was due to the same exact thing, and people lost a lot of money during dot-com. So, you know, like I said before, I don't think that AI, I don't think it's really artificial intelligence, but it is a thing, and it does do things, and it is useful to a degree. I think it's overvalued. I think there's a lot of hype, very much like the dot-com was hype. People thought that if you put a dot-com at the end of anything, you know, a pet food, you'd be a trillionaire. So a lot of people put a lot of money into a lot of questionable commerce on the Internet, and when the bubble burst, a couple of people survived, but a lot of people didn't. Not everyone invested or could invest in Amazon. A lot of them invested in Petco. So, you know, the trouble is... the odds are usually against people, unless they're insiders, and then it's a perfect storm for those guys. They know exactly what's going on.
Wait, this is Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf, Sam, and I'll be listening to the evening. Thank you, Roy.
You're welcome, Sam. Someone wanted to make a comment a little bit earlier, or what would you like to say?
That's me, Roy, KD2VHT.
Oh, okay, Jim.
It's interesting, the two comparisons or analogies of AI to crypto and to Bluetooth. They're relevant to speak of, but the interesting thing about crypto is I think it's a completely illegitimate thing. But it may be more legitimate than what we've considered money up to this point. So where does that put us? And the other comparison is the Bluetooth. Bluetooth is a handy thing. Most people don't realize what Bluetooth really does. Is a thing called Bluetooth Low Energy. It doesn't shut off when you shut off the Bluetooth on your device. It's constantly doing stuff that you don't know about. Most of these things are a scam on one level or another. And I think the fake intelligence is on the top of the cake of that scale. That's my feeling. Back to Roy.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure why we're all talking about Bluetooth. I mean, it's nice. It's interesting. You know, it's just a protocol for two-way communication, low power, local. It started very, very local, you know, a couple of feet, and it's been getting longer distance and more efficient and lower power capability. And, you know, it's a tool. Ultimately, it's a tool. You can use a hammer to build a house. You could use a hammer to cave in your neighbor's skull. You could use Bluetooth low power to supplement your headset. You know, a lot of times I'll have my Bluetooth matched to my iPad, and if I get beyond a certain distance in my house, the Bluetooth will fail because it's a little too far away for that particular Bluetooth protocol. So, you know, I mean, again, whatever man invents, some guy can figure out a way to either steal money or kill people or do some damage to someone or something. So, I mean, that's just unfortunately a given. So I have nothing particularly against Bluetooth. I don't think people made a heck of a lot of money off of Bluetooth. You probably would have made a had a lot more money if you bought Apple stock right when Steve Jobs came back the second time. But, you know, times like this that I wish I did have a little time machine, you know, make an extra couple of billion dollars here and there. Anyway, any other comments before we move on with the main segment? Okey-doke, we're open for business. If anyone has any questions or comments or topics for discussion tonight, preferably start off with amateur radio-related ones, please hit that push-to-talk, give me your first name, your call sign, whether it's amateur radio-related or not.
PhD, I'll throw in.
Okay, Jimmy, on the list. Anyone else want to put their name down on the list? Gosh, this is really going to, looks like it might be a very short episode of the Limar Technical Net, although we've started like this before and gone on until, 11 o'clock. Anyway, one more time out there. If anyone has any questions or comments or topics and they want to go on the list, please hit that push to talk. Okay, Jim, what do you got for us tonight?
Unfortunately, it's a retread, but I was wondering if anybody else had anything else to throw in on my query of last week about the concept that a resonant half-wave, not a dipole, but a half-wave NFED, could potentially be not only not requiring a counterpoise theoretically, and possibly really, and actually it'd be a downside, and it should not potentially have a counterpoise. Should be thoroughly choked, matched for impedance, and left alone. I was wondering if anybody else could add to that conversation.
Okay, anyone else out there? I gave my 2 cents worth last week, but if anyone has anything to add to the question, please hit that push to talk.
This is in 2 a.m.
Yeah.
Okay, hello, Roy, and everybody on the TechNet. You talk about a half-wave antenna, which does not need a counterpoise. I don't know who made it, but we'll digress back into the mid-1980s. A friend of mine had a boat, and he had a problem mounting. It was a 220 megahertz antenna on his boat because it was all fiberglass. There was nothing real metal to mount the antenna on, so one of the antenna companies back then, I don't remember which one, actually had a half-wave antenna, which had a whole bunch of chokes, I assume, on it, that he could mount on his boat, and it worked quite effectively. It was half-wave length long, and I assume it was massively choked to prevent RF from getting back into the equipment, etc., but I wish I remembered the name of the antenna, name of the company that had it, but back in the 80s, such a product did exist and was sold to the amateur community. So if anybody wants to do the research on it, they can, but it just brings back a memory from the mid-80s, which might be applicable. This is M2 AM back to that.
Okay, very good. Thank you. We kind of brought up the concept of marine antennas acting very, very strangely because, you know, they have pretty much a perfect ground. You know, they have a nice, flat, smooth, salt water, highly, very low resistance. And so, you know, when you have that kind of weird environment that isn't reproducible on land, you can sort of get away with a whole bunch of interesting oddities that seem like an antenna is working with completing a circuit with one wire, which isn't the way we think of electrical currents and such. But, I don't think that that's translatable on land because of the special case of seawater and such that you're dealing with marine antennas.
Okay, that's a good point, Roy, but this was not a marine antenna used in an ocean environment. This was used at a freshwater lake. As a matter of fact, it was used up at Greenwood Lake, which separates New York and New Jersey up in northern New Jersey. It's a seven-mile-long lake, which has a lot of boat traffic, et cetera. And I don't think it would be the same thing in fresh water than in salt water. This is at 2 a.m.
I don't know. The only thing that's high-resistance water is distilled water. You got to really purify it. And although fresh water is not salt water, it still does have salt, and I'd be willing to bet that it has a relatively low resistance as opposed to distilled water has.
Okay, that's an interesting point. Okay, just figured I'd bring it up and toss that in the mix. Hopefully it didn't muddy the waters. This is at 2 a.m.
No, I appreciate your participation. Jim, what do you think of that?
It certainly seems to be an interesting part of the conversation. It definitely has merit. I come across a very interesting story at some point, a couple stories in a video, that where somebody was making an antenna for a boat where they used a stream of water. I think it was targeted in the saltwater environment. A stream of water shot out of a nozzle off the boat, and they were actually had an electrode in that stream of water and using the stream of water itself as an antenna. All sorts of complications arise there, but it's just very interesting. And the connectivity and the RF connectivity of water versus salt water is definitely a piece of the puzzle, no doubt.
Yeah, it's very difficult to get high-resistance water. You basically have to buy distilled water. Any kind of, you know, even a small amount of dissolved salts. And, you know, our drinking water is full of dissolved salts. If you've ever seen, you know, some sink water kind of dry up, it usually leaves some calcium, white crud that precipitates out. So most of the water that we deal with tends to be actually conducting electricity. There might be a slight variation between heavily salty water and just slightly salty water, but it just takes surprisingly small amounts of dissolved salt for the ions to operate as charge carriers. Yes, Ed.
I opened up my 2017 radio amateur, AWR radio amateur handbook. And I have a picture here with flashing all designs for in-phase airwaves. It shows an open wire tube going up to a couple of insulators. One insulator is where you actually antenna wind. Then between that and the same insulator is one side of the open wire feeder. The other side of the open wire feeder goes to the actual half-wave radiator. And at the end, there's another insulator for that end mounted support. And that's all that I can seem to find about a end-fed half-wave.
Okay, but, some poises are a lot more obvious than other counterpoises. And, as I mentioned last week and such, there are some people who theorize that, just for a couple of inches worth is enough counterpoise to balance an unbalanced half-wave end set. Sometimes it kind of takes over the transmission line outer shielding, and sometimes it just takes, that little stub of a piece of conducting wire that isn't part of the radiating antenna. So I tend to think that if you look long and hard enough, you'll find something that physics is using as a counterpoise, although it might not be obvious to most of us.
FGCC on frequency.
Hello, Brian?
Good evening. I'm here on standby.
Okay, there's a lot of strange noise underneath you, so I don't know. It doesn't quite sound like interference. It sounds more like, I don't know, something's crunching around there. It, we're talking about Jim wanted to bring up the NFED half wave without a counterpoise that he mentioned last week. He wanted to know if there were any other people who hadn't talked last week who wanted to comment on whether they thought that you could have an NFED half wave with absolutely positively no counterpoise. I don't want to beat a dead horse. I kind of said last week that somehow you got to balance it. It's like a seesaw that's sawed in half. It just isn't going to work that way. So there's an invisible other end of the seesaw someplace if you look hard enough. If you have any extra things to say about NFED counterpoises, feel free.
Thank you, Jesus. I do.
Okay, well, go, Brian, and Ed recognized. Yes, Ed recognized. We'll get to you right after Brian.
Okay. An NFED antenna is essentially a dipole that's been relocated in terms of the RF balance. So you do have a counterpoise. The counterpoise is your coax that's going from the transformer into your shack. And the other side of the transformer is your wire. So that's what makes the that's the coax is the counterpoise, and with that you need a common mode filter, and you have to go ahead and it's a delicate compromise, and you most likely will need an auto tuner as well.
Okay, let's not bring up auto tuners because that's another subject entirely. The problem is the way you described it works. If you don't supply a counterpoise to a half-wave NFED, physics will simply use the outer shield current common mode as a counterpoise. What Jim states is, you know, he believes that you can choke the common mode at the very very beginning of the coax, which stops it from acting as a counterpoise. If you have a proper RF choke, if you have a proper total and complete common mode current choke, you won't be able to use the outer shield as a counterpoise. So what happens then is the question.
I would think that I'm not too sure about, but I would think that you wouldn't be able to go ahead and match it properly.
Well, I mean, you could almost match anything. If you have enough of a tuner with enough capacitance and inductance, you could tune a doorknob. So theoretically, it's within the realm of possibility that you can still tune it. So the problem is that it won't be an efficient antenna. So you won't, the amount of energy you're transferring to it is going to be terrible. So like anything, you know, almost even a doorknob will act as a very mediocre antenna, but pretty much anything will operate, even a dummy load to a small extent. You know, unless you buy a $10,000 dummy load, those things have leaks. And so effectively, it operates as a very, very poor antenna. So we fall back to the same question of ultimately, if you remove anything that can act as a counterpoise on an NFED half wave, will it operate in any way other than really, really terrible?
I would say that if you have, let's say, 2 feet of coax, which is nothing, then the only way to go ahead and make it efficient and perhaps have a match would be extending the wire to like maybe 133 feet or longer to make it a half wave depending on the frequency that would be resonant.
I'm kind of lost. What wire are you elongating? Are you elongating the half-wave antenna? If so, then you're not making it a half-wave by lengthening it because it started off halfway. If you're talking about something else, then you're making a counterpoise again.
Let's say, for example, you have 2 feet of coax, just for the sake of discussion. So you really don't have coax acting as a counterpoise, really. And then you extend the antenna to maybe, let's say, depending on frequency, let's say 40 meters, for example, you would want to turn that into a half wave, and you use the formula and extend the wire. That would be your radiance part, and extend that out longer, you might be able to get a better match.
Yeah, but it's not an end-fed half-wave anymore. I'm not quite sure exactly why you say you're extending it so it's a half-wave. It started out as a half-wave. So if you're extending something that was a half-wave, you know, unless you're making it for another band, which isn't going to solve anything, it's just now we're talking about 40 meters instead of, say, 20 meters. But it's the same fundamental policy. And some people will suggest that, you know, a couple of inches of counterpoise is better than none. So if you have 2 feet of unchoked transmission line, that might be sufficient to give you an acceptable result for an end-fed half-wave.
I mean, yeah, I totally agree with you. It would be dependent. When you say half wave, when they say end-fed half wave, it all depends on the radiant part of the antenna. Okay, what is it going to be resonant on to be a half wave? So the half wave, you may have to make it longer depending on the band that you want to have a half wave resonancy.
Perhaps I can clarify.
Okay, Jim, clarify.
So I think we need a metaphorical counterpoise to explore the electrical counterpoise, and that's the quarter wave antenna. The way I'm understanding it, and realize I'm not trying to be a wizard. I'm just trying to understand, and I thank you all for your help. But a quarter wave antenna connected to a coax, quarter wave length of wire, connected to the center conductor of a piece of coax, and then a quarter wavelength back from that connection, an effective choke, and a matching transformer if it's necessary. It doesn't sound like it would be in that case, but you would have the quarter wave radiator, and the counterpoise to that would be the other half of the antenna, the half wave of coax shield that has the common mode on it that creates the other half of the antenna. So the one half of the antenna is the quarter wave radiator. The other half of the antenna is the quarter wave common mode current happening on the coax shield that stops at the choke. So in a half wave radiator, the way I'm understanding it, and if I'm crazy or wrong or not getting something, say so. But there is no other half of the antenna because it's not a quarter wave. It's a half wave. It's a full antenna, the way I'm understanding. And if it's choked at that feed point, and if the impedance is matched, that should be the whole antenna, in theory. In theory. Understanding the reality has changed a little bit. Maybe a little counterpoise makes the reality work. But am I off somewhere? That's what I'm asking.
Okay, Ed.
A half wave antenna is only a half wave at a particular frequency. We can feed it many different ways. We can feed it in the center, and people call it a dipole. We don't have to feed it in the center. We can feed it off center, and we can find an impedance someplace there 300 ohms, and it works very well with some open wire line. Or we could feed it at an end, which has a very, very high impedance, and a 49-to-1 balun works very, very nice at the end. Now, the balun has, on the high impedance side, two wires. One wire we connect to the end of our antenna. Now we have another wire. We could connect it to the coax shield, and we can put a choke a quarter of the way down the coax, or we can just put another wire a quarter wave. It doesn't have to run straight, and this is the solution. I tell you what I did years ago with a very similar antenna. Let me just take a break.
Comment.
Let it finish, and then we'll hear you.
Okay, years ago, I had an antenna that was a wavelength, and I fed it a quarter wave off one end. It meant that one side of the antenna was a quarter wavelength, and the other side of the antenna was three quarters of a wavelength. And what happens there, it looked like a dipole with a quarter wave and another half wave, which is a repeater. So it only repeated the high impedance, and it worked very well. I'll break now. Over for comment.
Okay, we'll have Brian right after I just say a couple of things. None of us are actually answering Jim's question. We're postulating other antennas, which is all well and good. I love talking about antennas. But he's specifically talking about an end-fed half-wave with a common mode choke at the very beginning of the transmission line. That's what he's talking about. And everyone's kind of lengthening things and shortening things and putting counterpoises on them, which is fine. That's how things work. But Jim's question relates to me at least, to a very specific, very, very narrow, broad type of an end-fed half-wave that's choked at the antenna feed point. So maybe we can kind of address that, because I think that's what Jim's talking about. And we can talk about all kinds of other lovely antennas that resonate and work perfectly fine. Brian, you wanted to say something.
Yes. A off-sensor fed, an end-fed antenna, okay, is essentially a shifted dipole where you have a counterpoise, and you're shifting it with that transformer, okay, to go ahead and achieve a match with the wire that's coming out. It's not a balanced antenna. If it was a balanced antenna, like a true dipole, you wouldn't need that kind of a balun. You would not. It would, actually, it's an unun, not even a balun. So it's completely different. I mean, for a half-wave antenna operating at 14 megahertz, the length should be approximately, I think, around like 33 feet or something like that. You know, if using the... That's the way that I understand it. Maybe I'm incorrect. I'm not an antenna expert by any means.
Ed, what do you want to say?
That a true end-on frequency is what should be happening. I was trying to address the original question. Now, first of all, there's a question about a four-wave antenna. A four-wave antenna is you're taking a dipole, turning it in half, and replacing one side of it with ground plane. A true four-wave has to work against the ground plane. Another item is that if you're talking about all these combinations of permutations for an end-fed antenna, one, rising intensity instead of centipedes. A centipede dipole is just two wires coming from centipede, the coax or open sea or whatever. A balun is optional, it's nice, but it's by no means mandatory. And what I'm saying is, the beauty of a plastic dipole is it gives you a decent piece without any complicated stuff. An end-fed half-wave, as I understand, will give you a very high impedance. So it's all of this trying to match the impedance, or control the radiation pattern, or what? I'm a little confused. What's the role of this?
I think people love... Let me answer first, and then you can answer second. What people find a lot agreeable about NFEDs half waves is that if you build them right, they work on multiple frequencies, multiple bands, and you can game multi-band for amateur radio on an NFED. And also, it just has two connections instead of the three connections that a centifed dipole. The problem, as you mentioned, is that with a center-fed dipole, you have a nominal impedance of 50 ohms, which is what your transmitter line and what your transmitter is designed to utilize. So you don't have to worry too much, as long as it's resonant, to do anything about impedances. They're matching. When you put it to the end, the impedance goes up to 2,000, 3,000 ohms of impedance, and you have to correct that with an unun. So and the ununs are terribly lossy. So it's not as inefficient as a centifed dipole. But as I've often said, because it's so difficult to measure antenna efficiency, most people aren't concerned with efficiency. If they get to the guy that they're trying to transmit to and they're only operating at 10% efficiency, as long as no one tells them that, they're more than happy. So the other person who wanted to make a comment, feel free.
Comment
away.
When I originally planned my a true dipole, or even a fan dipole, the problem is that the coax is dead center. And my wife didn't want the coax coming down in the backyard, okay? And then tunneling under the ground to the shack. So I had to settle for a off-center fed dipole, which necessitated the use of an auto tuner to choose the correct match depending on band, you know, the frequency. And that's where I am. So if I had it my way, the true dipole or fan dipole would be the choice. But since I don't, I have to go with what I have, and I have to go ahead and live with that for right now.
Okay, I mean, we all make compromises. We didn't, you know, I'm sure if we had an infinite amount of money in real estate and no neighbors who would get upset, we would have all kinds of lavish antenna farms, but we don't. So we all kind of compromise as best we can. And, you know, I have nothing inherently against an NFED. It's very popular, and that's great. Again, it's not terribly efficient, but all you need is enough energy to get to the other station. And so most people find an NFED half-wave to be fine for most of their purposes. And so, but we keep kind of going back to whether it's really appropriate to think of NFED half waves as counterpoiseless antennas. I don't think so. I think if you don't supply an obvious poise, the laws of physics will kind of put together something, or otherwise your antenna will really be very compromising. So, Jim, I think you were the last person to want to say something.
Yes, I really appreciate exploring the topic. I had asked what was the circumstances that led to the question, and it's a situation where you have a 300 feet of property and the shack is at one end of it, and if you want to run 160 meters, feeding it from the middle is just not practical in many circumstances. If you can feed it from the end. So that's what brought the idea into mind. And I want to clarify, I'm not talking about a multi-band end fed, which is a whole other topic, and it's a whole other interesting topic unto itself. I'm talking about a resonant half-wave antenna, which from what I'm seem to be understanding is a quarter wave is a half an antenna, but a half wave is a full antenna. It's able to make the wave that transmits through the sky over the salt water or the fresh water or the land happily, if I'm understanding it correctly. I may not be. But matching the whole thing, if you get the impedance squared away and you choke it so that it's not using common mode current on the shield, you're just making a happy wave on that half-wave wavelength radiator. Theoretically, from what I'm understanding, that should work. Now, I understand theoretically and reality are completely two different things. But what is the element at work at this particular circumstance? I'm having a very difficult time understanding it because it's still very interesting. Back to Roy.
Comment.
Yeah, Brian, comment.
A off-center fed antenna, or end-fed antenna, is a compromised antenna. It is not... If you have a true dipole ratio, okay, and that's not the case with a off-center fed because of the design. Okay, you have to go ahead and live with the compromise. That's exactly what it is. However, the longer you could extend the wire on that off-center fed, the more ability you will have to go ahead and be resonant with a lower SWR on certain frequencies, depending.
Okay, but again, I don't think that answers or addresses even Jim's inquiry. I think ultimately, when you have some unusual circumstance, like a flat, smooth, conducting ground that the water is, in the most part, I know of no naturally existing distilled water lakes or anything. So they're all conductive, and they're all level, and they go out for a long distance. Under those circumstances, you could have a virtual antenna, mirroring the non-counterpoise, halfway. But I mean, generally speaking, with dubious ground, non-perfect ground, you need a counterpoise. That's the only takeaway that I kind of would like to offer to everyone. That it may not be obvious, but it needs a counterpoise. Otherwise, it's not a balanced antenna. Once you make it off-center, it's no longer balanced. So you have to be a little bit more critical about putting a ballon in to limit the amount of reflections going on at the mismatch of a balanced versus unbalanced type of antenna system. So ultimately, you need some kind. Your quarter wave doesn't really relate to the half wave. The quarter wave uses the top quarter wave antenna as one leg of the dipole and uses the common mode external aspect of the coax that's a quarter wave before it gets choked as the other leg of the dipole. So you could say that it's a counterpoise, but you could just as easily say that it's the other quarter wave. So you really, although it looks to you like it's a quarter wave monopole, the choked quarter wave of the coax is operating as the other leg of the dipole.
I have an important point.
Okay, Brian?
Okay. On the transformer, okay, the Unin, most of them will let you attach another wire. That wire will act as a counterpoise. So, if your coax run is very short, you could attach wire to the terminal on the Unun, and you could go ahead and lay it out, let's say in a straight line, opposite direction, and you could go ahead and use that also. I don't want to use the term double counterpoise, but that's essentially what it is. It's extending it from another end as well to go ahead and act as that other part to go ahead and try to balance out the antenna.
Again, that's not Jim.
Would a comment.
Okay, John, what do you got?
Well, I think the getting back to the original question was, why is the counterpoise minimal on the end-fed half-wave? I think that was the question. The reason you see minimal counterpoise, minimal number of radials on half-wave fed antennas, or end-fed half-waves, is because the impedance is so high. So to get a ground reference, it doesn't take a lot of radials. When you have a quarter wave antenna, since that's a relatively low impedance point there, A, that's why you can drive it directly from coax, but to get a good counterpoise, you need a lot of radials, because the end-fed half-wave, the driving point impedance is up there around 2,500 ohms or so. That's why you need a 49-to-1 Unun to bring that down to 50 ohms. But because the impedance is high, the radials or counterpoise you need are minimal. And that's the case with the R7 vertical design. It has a minimal number of radials because it is basically an end-fed half-wave system. So the radials are minimal. They're short. If I can, if anybody has the ARRL antenna book, 25th edition, on page 19.2, where they talk about the end-fed half-wave, they show an end-fed half-wave with a minimal amount of counterpoise, just a wire about 5 to 10 feet. So if anybody has that book, they might want to check that. Again, that's page 19.2 in the 25th edition of the ARRL handbook. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, John, I agree with you entirely. Again, I think we're all kind of falling back on answering someone else's question, not particularly Jim's. You can get by on a small counterpoise, but you need a counterpoise. And the thing that he's presenting is, do you really need a counterpoise? To which I keep on saying, yeah, in some form or shape. Now, some Ununs do have a ground connection that they tell to use as a counterpoise. Some people just put a wire just hanging out of it. Others have a longer wire that goes to a ground rod. But you know, that's what they're doing for that particular set of Ununs. There are 49-to-1 Ununs, unfortunately, just to confuse everyone, that don't have that ground tap, in which I think they just expect the common mode of the transmission line to act as a counterpoise in those Unun designs. So I'm trying to pull it back to Jim's basic question, which is it possible to have a decent end-fed half-wave without anything being used as a counterpoise?
Well, the system will automatically select part of the coax. As you mentioned, the system will use part of the coax as the counterpoise if you don't provide any. But again, it is kind of minimal. Usually the counterpoise comes off on the cold side of that Unun. That Unun is basically just a step-up transformer at RF frequencies. And the other side, one side drives the end-fed half-wave, and the other side, usually your coax shield connects to it, which is where you would connect your minimal counterpoise. And if you don't have one, it will be the coax shield.
Okay, so basically we two agree. This is what I've been saying for 2 weeks on, plus. That physics will out. They want a counterpoise, they'll get a counterpoise. It might not be obvious to you or me that it's a counterpoise, but to the laws of physics it is. So unless you have a very special case like a you know, in a lake or a sea where you have a perfect ground kind of acting as some kind of a counterpoise, virtual counterpoise or something. For all the land-based cases, you need to supply some form of a counterpoise for an end-fed halfway.
Comment.
Yes, Brian?
No, but I don't think there's any way to cheat the end-fed. I mean, I have a friend who has... An end-fed is not an omnidirectional antenna.